Fighting rages on between government and Taliban militants on the outskirts of three major cities in Afghanistan. Demonstrations are held across France against the COVID health pass and compulsory vaccinations. And Russia registers over 23,000 new daily coronavirus cases while grappling with a surge of the Delta variant. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Afghanistan, where fighting rages on between government and Taliban forces on the outskirts of three major cities in southern and western Afghanistan. Officials and residents reported that Taliban militants have entered parts of Herat, Lashkargah, and Kandahar, seeking to seize the cities from government forces. In Herat, hundreds of people have fled their homes to seek shelter closer to the heart of the city. Now, this a day after the militants attacked the main UN compound in Herat on Friday, killing a security guard. Now, the Taliban launched a widespread offensive across the country in early May. Militants that control about half of Afghanistan's districts, including the border crossings with Iran and Pakistan. Crossing over to Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Amin, tell us about this new offensive and what's going on.
Well, Marcia, following the capture of over 100 districts, the Taliban militants have now decided to capture some major cities, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. Lashkargah, the capital city of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, was the scene of heavy fightings between Afghan security forces and Taliban militants. According to military sources in Helmand province, hundreds of Taliban militants have launched a heavy attack on some parts of the city of Lashkargah. But according to General Sameh Sadat, who is a top army commander in southern Afghanistan, Afghan security forces, mainly Afghan commander troops, have pushed back Taliban attacks on Lashkargah, the capital city of Helmand province. In the meantime, local officials in southern Kandahar city also say that Taliban militants have also been pushed back as a result of strong resistance by Afghan security and defense forces in outskirts of Kandahar, the capital city of the main province in southern Afghanistan. As these officials in southern Afghanistan, as well as here in Afghanistan's defense ministry, as well as Afghanistan's interior ministry, say over 300 Taliban militants have been killed during their attacks on Lashkargah and Kandahar cities in southern Afghanistan. Military sources here also insist that there were many foreign nationals among the Taliban militants who have been killed by Afghan security forces, mainly Pakistanis. In the meantime, a large-scale attack was also conducted by Taliban militants on Herat, the capital city of Herat province in western Afghanistan. This province is considered as one of the most strategic provinces, and Herat, the capital city of this province, is also known as one of the red lines and one of the most important fronts of the Afghan government. As you mentioned, hundreds of families have been displaced from inside of this city because the Taliban militants, according to local sources in Herat city, have reached to Marlan Bridge, that is located very close to the city of Herat. The rising attacks of Taliban militants on the city of Herat prompted many influential leaders, mainly Ismail Khan, to pick up guns and resist against Taliban militants. As they say, Afghan security forces and former jihadi leaders, mainly Ismail Khan, who is known as the Emir or the commander of Western Afghanistan locally, will defeat the Taliban and will push back their attacks from the city, not only from the city of on the city of Herat, but also they will successfully retake some key areas, mainly Islam Qala, that is a border point between Afghanistan and Iran in western part of this country. But Marzia, let's not forget that clashes are not only ongoing in southern Afghanistan, mainly in Kandahar, Helmand, or western Afghanistan in Herat province. As security sources in northern Faryab and Juzjan provinces say, hundreds of Taliban militants were had also conducted heavy-scale attacks on many key areas of these provinces. In the meantime, local residents as well as the members of provincial council for Tahar province also say that a number of Taliban militants were killed as a result of counter-attack operations conducted by Afghan security forces and public armed fronts in outskirts of Taliqan, that is the capital city of Tahar province. In the meantime, northeast of Afghanistan is also the scene of heavy clashes between Afghan forces and Taliban militants there. According to Afghanistan's defense ministry, at least 10 Taliban militants, including two Chechen nationals, were killed during battles with Afghan security forces. But let's not forget that currently most of the districts all over Afghanistan are either under the control of Taliban or under the heavy attacks by the militant group. And furthermore, the militants want to take control over some key cities, as I mentioned, mainly in western and southern Afghanistan.
What's the overall feel that you're getting from the people on the ground that you're talking to? Is it anxiety about the situation? Tell me your assessment of I'd like to know from the Afghan people's perspective.
Of course, Marcia, Afghans are, especially civilians or locals, are the main victims of the bloody war in Afghanistan. I talked to many displaced people over the past days who have reached to capital Kabul, and they are living inside many internally displaced camps as well as inside some mosques and public places like cultural centers. Many of them said that we have not seen a strong resistance by Afghan security forces. In some cases, they said that we have realized that there was a deal behind the collapse of hundreds of districts all over Afghanistan. I talked to some residents of Taliqan, the capital city of Tahar province in north of Afghanistan, and some local residents of who are displaced people as well, local residents of Malistan district in southern Ghazni province. They said that the Taliban easily captured their areas, and they easily pushed back the Afghan security forces from those areas, except they faced strong resistance by some public fronts, mainly in Malistan and Taliqan city of northern Tahar province. Locals, especially the displaced people, say that they need and they call on the Afghan government and the Taliban militant group to pay respect to their demand, that is basically their lives and their livings and their properties everywhere across Afghanistan. In the meantime, thousands of these internally displaced people also call on some international bodies, mainly the United Nations, as well as regional countries and rights bodies to responsibly interfere and put an end to the ongoing war in Afghanistan, or at least convince the Taliban militant group to say yes to peace negotiations and finally approved a long-lasting ceasefire in this country. In the meantime, some others believe, and these are not only local people who believe, that the U.S. was behind legitimizing the Taliban militant group that was ousted from power almost 20 years ago. Ismail Khan, who is the leader of public uprising forces in Herat City in western Afghanistan, just recently said that it was Washington that legitimized the presence of Taliban militants, and now many states across the region and even many other states in Europe and across the United, across many other countries in the U.S. also believe that the Taliban is a political movement, while according to these critics of the policies of both Washington and Kabul, the Afghan government must not pay heed to the expansionist demands of Taliban and their foreign backers. Instead, the Afghan government, or in response, the Afghan government has repeatedly said that there was not any deal behind the collapse of hundreds of districts into the Taliban hands, and it was a tactical retreat from those districts by Afghan forces.
All right. Thank you so much, Amin Alami, for that update. Out of Kabul, meanwhile, now turning to Yemen, where the Yemeni army says its armed forces have successfully accomplished the second phase of an operation in the central province of Al-Bayadah. Forces liberated two districts of Nomad and Nata that were under the control of the Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists backed by Saudi-led coalition. More in the following report.
A new victory against the Saudi-backed militant groups was made by Yemen's armed forces in the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sari'a, said Nu'man and Nata regions of the country's central province of Al-Bayda were fully liberated from the control of the Saudi-backed terrorists. He said the military operation had left hundreds of Saudi-backed militants killed and injured, adding that the Yemeni forces had also captured a number of the militants.
Our armed forces have completed the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, which led to the liberation of the districts of Nateh and Nu'man and the defeat of the elements of the militant groups associated with the Saudi-led coalition and inflicting heavy losses on them, while hundreds of them were killed, wounded, and captured.
Sari'a also said the Yemeni forces have confiscated militants' weapons, which are U.S.-made, according to military experts. They say this is yet another proof of the U.S. military support for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen.
This operation proved that the United States supports terrorist groups, whether militarily or through statements accusing the Yemeni army of hampering the peaceful solutions. America is the one who directs and controls the terrorist groups. Today, there is a lot of evidence proving Washington's support for terrorist groups, including American-made weapons that the Yemeni army seized during the recent operation.
2 weeks ago, the Yemeni army took control of large areas in Al-Bayda, the first stage of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation that was launched on July 13th. The operation was part of military efforts to push members of Al-Qaeda and Daesh out of their strongholds in Al-Bayda.
Observers say the U.S. support for the terrorist groups in Al-Bayda is aimed at hampering the Yemeni army's advances toward Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. However, the Yemeni army says it will continue the operations until the liberation of all Yemeni territories and putting an end to years-long Saudi-imposed war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The African Union's decision to grant Israel observer status has drawn fierce criticism from Palestinians and some other African nations. In the latest, Namibia joined South Africa along with several continental civil society groups to condemn the AU's decision. But what was the reason behind the move, and what does the regime want in Africa?
On Thursday, Israel attained observer status at the African Union after nearly 20 years of lobbying. Making the move official, Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Burundi, and Chad presented his credentials to Moussa Faki Mohamed, the chairman of the African Union Commission, at the bloc's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
But for African countries, Palestine is now no longer a priority. Unfortunately, for some Arab countries that have turned their back to Palestine, this is the same.
the move was met with harsh criticism from Palestinian resistance groups and several African nations. In a letter to the chairperson of the African Union, head of Hamas political wing Ismail Haniyeh said the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union toward the Palestinian cause. South Africa also fiercely objected to the move by the Union. It said the AU Commission made the decision unilaterally without consulting its members.
Now, none of the member states were officially consulted, except those that are probably pro-Israeli. The pro-Israeli ones are well known. It's Kenya, it's Tanzania, it's Rwanda, Togo, Cameroon. These are the countries that are backing this move.
The South African Foreign Ministry has called the AU's move, quote, incomprehensible and inexplicable.
The demonstrations are once again being held across France against the COVID health pass and compulsory vaccinations. Marches were held in Paris and also planned in several other cities, including Marseille, Bordeaux, and Nice. Some 3,000 police officers have been deployed to the capital alone. Last weekend, an estimated 160,000 people marched against the measure announced by President Emmanuel Macron earlier this month. The new COVID health pass came into effect in France amid a surge of new infections. Well, people need proof of vaccination, a negative test, or recent recovery from COVID to enter most museums and cinemas. Lawmakers have also approved to extend its use for entry to cafes, restaurants, and shopping malls. COVID-19 in France has infected more than 6 million people and has claimed the lives of nearly 112,000 others. Russia has registered over 23,000 new coronavirus cases during the past day while grappling with the surge of the Delta variant. Russian health officials also recorded another 792 COVID-related deaths on Saturday. This pushed the country's coronavirus death toll to over 158,000. Russia reported 799 deaths on Thursday, which was the third all-time high in the last month. The new daily cases bring the country's total caseload to over 6.2 million. Meanwhile, Germany logged 2,400 new infections, raising the national tally to 3.7 million cases. Official figures also show 21 new fatalities from the respiratory disease. The rise in COVID-19 infections has prompted Germany to tighten entry rules for unvaccinated travelers. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
outrage against the Zionist regime's ongoing apartheid system and routine attacks on Palestinian rights and lives is mounting worldwide, setting the stage for a new burst of energy in the global movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, against the Israeli regime. A nonviolent movement in support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and equality. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Outrage over Zionist regime's human rights violations is fueling global BDS movement. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime police are now threatening to carry out mass arrests against Palestinian citizens of occupied territories. Arrests intended to punish those who took part in sit-ins and other protests in solidarity with Palestinians living in East Al-Quds and Gaza. This latest attack on Palestinian rights comes just days after Zionist regime police once again attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque and after the Zionist regime military viciously bombed Gaza for 11 days, killing 248 Palestinians and wounded more than 1,900, destroying 16,800 Palestinian homes and displacing tens of thousands of Palestinians. Outrage against the Zionist regime's ongoing apartheid system and routine attacks on Palestinian rights and lives is mounting worldwide, setting the stage for a new burst of energy in the global movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, against the Zionist regime, a nonviolent movement in support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and equality. Renewed calls for BDS have emerged in the reshaped new political moment following the ceasefire that began on May 20th, after President Joe Biden, who has essentially continued Donald Trump's policy of pandering to the Zionist regime, finally put his foot down following outrage by a critical mass of congressional Democrats and protests in the U.S. and around the world, and said he expected significant de-escalation of Israel's attacks on Palestinians. In the occupied territories, the Zionist regime regulates the entries and departures of Palestinians and controls of the borders, airspace, shoreline, and waters off the Gaza coast. The Zionist regime expels Palestinians from their homes and facilitates illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Palestinians are forced to live in constant uncertainty, making it difficult to perform simple tasks and make plans, according to B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights organization. The BDS movement is largely modeled on the boycott that helped end apartheid in South Africa. As has been confirmed most recently by Human Rights Watch, the Zionist regime also maintains a system of apartheid. In 2001, the National Lawyers Guild sent a delegation to the region and published a report that documented the system of apartheid in occupied Palestine. It detailed illegal Jewish settlements and bypass roads, the restricted movement of Palestinians, discriminatory land policies, the differential treatment of Jews and Palestinian non-Jews, and the Zionist regime policing of Palestinians' political expression. It analyzed the indiscriminate and excessive use of lethal force against Palestinians and their property, delays and prevention of medical treatment, and the Zionist regime's collective punishment of the Palestinians. boycotts involve the withdrawal of support for the Zionist regime and Zionist and international companies that are violating Palestinian human rights, including Israeli regime academic, cultural, and sporting institutions. Divestment companies ask churches, universities, banks, pension funds, and local councils to withdraw their investments from all Israeli and international companies complicit in the violation of Palestinian rights. Sanctions campaigns pressure governments to cease military trade and free trade agreements and urge them to expel Israeli regime from international fora. BDS has had a significant impact on the Zionist regime. The BDS campaign played a major role in the 46% decrease in foreign direct investment in the Zionist regime in 2014, according to the UN Conference on Trade and Development. In a 2018 poll, 40% of Americans overall and 56% of Democrats supported the imposition of sanctions or even more serious penalties on the Zionist regime to end the occupation. Boycotts constitute protected freedom of speech, assembly, and association under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They have long been used to fight injustice and achieve social change. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that speech on public issues occupies the highest rung of the hierarchy of First Amendment values and is entitled to special protection. The High Court ruled that advocating and supporting boycotts to bring about political, social, and economic change, like boycotting the Israeli regime, are unquestionably protected by the First Amendment. Biden is staunchly against the BDS movement. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at his confirmation hearing that both he and Biden resolutely opposed BDS. Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, vehemently denounced BDS at her confirmation hearing, as did Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen in written answers to questions from senators before her hearing. The success of the BDS movement has motivated the Zionist regime apologists to sponsor anti-boycott legislation on the state, local, and federal levels. These forces include right-wing Christian Zionist organizations and other Israeli lobby groups often funded by the Israeli regime. 31 states have anti-BDS legislation in effect since 2014. 219 anti-boycott bills have been introduced, but only 50 of them have been passed, thanks to strong opposition by grassroots and civil liberties groups. The anti-boycott laws vary in how they define boycotts and the scope of the boycotts at which they are directed. Some bills target boycotts of the Zionist regime or goods and services from this regime, and others aim at boycotts of allied countries. The legislation often punishes boycotts of territories controlled by the Zionist regime, reaching boycotts of services or products from or to unlawful Israeli settlements. Many bills threaten criminal penalties and economic sanctions. This legislation also has a broader intent to chill and intimidate activists and their would-be supporters into believing that BDS is not illegal, Palestine legal website says. Some legislation, like the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which was introduced in Congress in 2017 and again in 2019, would have gone even further, with criminal penalties and jail for furnishing information in support of a boycott of the Israeli regime. The act was defeated in January 2021. The world watched horrified as the Zionist regime forces once again slaughtered Palestinians in Gaza, which is often called the world's largest open-air prison, one of the most densely populated areas on Earth, containing more than 5,000 inhabitants per square kilometer until they agreed on a ceasefire. This latest violence has galvanized even more people in the United States and around the world to stop the Zionist regime's brutality against the Palestinians. In this moment of mass outrage, as more people join the BDS movement and work together to overcome the strategies of repression and criminalization aimed to thwart it, BDS movement has the potential to grow and become an even more powerful force in the Palestinian struggle to end the Zionist regime's occupation and system of apartheid.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to Sheikh Zaidu Salami.
So when it comes to the wilada, the birth of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, there's a little bit of a difference of opinion. What you would regularly see is the dates being the 7th of Safar, which also coincides with the Shahada anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. Now, the view of many ulama is that, well, how could a ma'soom have been buried, have been born in this time of the sadness of Muharram and Safar? It's not possible. Is this hadith authentic? We don't have any of our imams being born during this time. If it was the case, then we would have to break our time of mourning and aza and celebrate the ma'soom. According to what a lot of our ulama have said, is that no, it's not the 7th of Safar, rather it is in Dhul-Hijjah, and we have many authentic ahadith that speak about Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam finishing his Hajj pilgrimage, heading back towards Al-Madinah Al-Munawwara, and the birth of our Imam happening then. And which exact dates? It would have been the last half of the Hijjah, would have been enough time for the Imam, for Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, to have finished his Hajj pilgrimage and have returned. And that's why some ulama say the last 10 days within, so one of the last 10 days of Dhul-Hijjah, others say no, it was the 20th of Dhul-Hijjah. Of course, there are many special qualities of the Imam, similar to our other Ma'sumeen, alayhim as-salam. But what really stands out as far as Imam Al-Kadhim's feature is concerned is that level of perseverance that he had, that level of patience that he had, that how much he endured the difficulties and sufferings that he went through, whether it be issues internal within his own family, which I'm going to be explaining very soon, or external as far as the khulafa of that time, especially the evil Harun al-Rashids. And I stress on that word evil because unfortunately we have a counter narrative that praises Harun al-Rashid in such a way which is beyond any level of recognition as far as fairness is concerned. And that's why, with all of these issues that he went through, he became very much known for that suppressing of anger and perseverance and patience and enduring of difficulties. And that's what Al-Kazm means, Kazm. In the Quran, this word is also used, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Wal-Kazimeen al-Ghayd, those who suppress their anger. والعافين عن الناس والله يحب المحسنين. And that's why there's a wonderful dua mentioned by Imam Al-Kazm alayhi salam, where he says, "Oh Allah, you know that I have been asking you to give me some time for myself exclusively to worship you. Free my time only so I can fill it up in worshipping you. Oh Allah, you have done that for me. فَلَكَ الْحَمْدِ. So praise be to you. Allahumma innaka ta'alam annani kuntu as'alaka an tufarrighani li'ibadatik. Allahumma waqad fa'alt. فَلَكَ الْحَمْدِ. What a beautiful dua from Imam Al-Kazm alayhi salam. As for Harun al-Rashid, who many call Harun al-Safih, Rashid basically means mature. Safih basically means immature. So instead of referring to them, him, or any of those others who have tried somehow to adopt the names of our Ma'sumin alayhim salam, you can see that Al-Hadi, Al-Muhtadi, Al-Mansur, Al-Musta'in, Al-Mu'taz, all these names resemble the names of our Ma'sumin alayhim salam. They wanted to get somewhere, but they weren't able to. Harun al-Safih, who governed the greater area of the Muslim territory at that time, and also, he was very well known for example, his interest in certain areas like education and whatnot. And that's why this counter narrative that is unfortunately mentioned by other groups in Islam, where they say, no, he was a good guy, he was a pious person, he was courageous. I heard a whole lecture today about the wonders and the virtues and the beautiful characteristics of Harun al-Rashid. Oh yeah, but he also mentions this as well. Oh yeah, but he did put some people in prison, and one of them was Musa al-Kazm for a while, and he ended up dying in prison as well. Subhanallah. See how they brush off. And that's why one of the reasons why he imprisoned Imam Musa al-Kazm alayhi salam was because of this, which is I'm going to be mentioning very soon, inshallah. Now, we all know that this was during the time of the decline of Bani Umayyah and the rise of Bani al-Abbas, especially with al-Mansur. And all these people that were there at that time were very harsh because they wanted to be as ruthless as possible to claim as much territory as they can. I mentioned that Imam Al-Kazm alayhi salam was born in Al-Madinah Al-Munawwara, and we've already spoken in a previous program about why they relocated from Al-Madinah, Bani Al-Abbas, Bani Umayyah. Why they didn't choose Al-Madinah to be their capital, why Bani al-Abbas changed the capital of the Muslim Khilafah from Dimashq and from Sham, and they went all the way to Baghdad, and why they had to turn away from Baghdad and go to Samarra and turn it into a fort. Baghdad deteriorated. At that time, they used to call it, and for a while after, they used to call it Medina to Salam, the city of peace. Even you can still see until today, there are some places where they still refer to Baghdad as Medina to Salam. And they ruined it, they destroyed it, Bani al-Abbas. And so the people of Baghdad, they were fed up and tired, so they were forced, the Abbasi Khilafah was forced to leave Baghdad and go somewhere else.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyumun Ra'uf Saburun Majid. صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
Those who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus should return to wearing face masks in indoor public spaces in areas that are seeing substantial or high virus transmission. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced on Tuesday, 27th of July, in a major reversal of its guidance. The article you're about to hear has been written by Cecilia Smith Schoenwalder, a journalist writing about science and the environment for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled CDC Reverses Guidance, says fully vaccinated people should wear masks inside in certain areas. Stay with us for more of Cecilia Smith Schoenwalder's article. Those who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus should return to wearing face masks in indoor public spaces in areas that are seeing substantial or high virus transmission. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced on Tuesday, 27th of July, in a major reversal of its guidance. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky cited worrisome new data that shows that fully vaccinated individuals could spread the highly contagious Delta variant if they experience a breakthrough infection. In recent days, I have seen new scientific data from recent outbreak investigations showing that the Delta variant of the coronavirus behaves uniquely differently from past strains of the virus that causes COVID-19. Rochelle Walensky said on a call with reporters without providing details about the data. Information on the Delta variant from several states and other countries indicate that in rare occasions, some vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant after vaccination may be contagious and spread the virus to others. Walensky said individuals can check the CDC's data tracker to see their community transmission on a county basis. Roughly 63% of U.S. counties are considered to have high or substantial transmission, according to the CDC data. When the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, previously relaxed its masking guidance in May, many jurisdictions and businesses followed suit, shifting to a sort of honor system in which those who are not fully vaccinated were expected to continue masking. As the Delta variant continued to spread, more experts pressured the agency to change its guidance. As of just last week, Rochelle Walensky stood by the previous guidance, saying, "Our guidance has been clear since we put it out several months ago, and that is, if you are unvaccinated, you should continue to wear a face mask and protect yourself against others around you." However, she added that, "We're always looking at the data as the data comes in, and that some individuals who are fully vaccinated can choose to mask up for an extra layer of protection." The agency on Tuesday, 27th of July, also said the masking guidance for those who are fully vaccinated applies to grades K-12, recommending everyone inside school buildings wear face masks regardless of vaccination status. It's yet another shift from roughly 3 weeks ago, when the agency relaxed masking guidelines for fully vaccinated students and school staff. The previous guidance faced pushback from some, and the American Academy of Pediatrics followed by publishing its own guidelines to encourage masking in schools, regardless of vaccination status. "When we released our school guidance on 9th of July, we had less Delta variant in this country. We had fewer cases in this country, and importantly, we were really hopeful that we would have more people vaccinated, especially in the demographic between 12 to 17 years old," Rochelle Walensky said, adding that only 30% of individuals in the age group are fully vaccinated. The guidance changes come as the Delta variant makes up the majority of new coronavirus cases in the United States, which is seeing an increase in infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. Unvaccinated individuals should still wear face masks indoors, according to CDC guidance. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, issued a statement saying teachers and students should wear face masks inside classrooms, regardless of whether they are fully vaccinated or not. The statement represents a backtrack that comes just 3 weeks after the government's top public health officials said it was safe for those vaccinated to be maskless inside school buildings. The updated guidance reflects the rapid increase in infections, transmission and hospitalizations stemming from the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, including among vaccinated individuals, and comes as the vast majority of schools across the country prepare to welcome students back for in-person learning full-time, 5 days a week, some for the first time in over a year.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The authority of religion has its origins in the Holy Quran and in Islamic narrations. The Quran has clearly spoken about the authority of religion. If someone denies that, it really shows that they have not deliberated carefully. A holy ayah in Surah Al-Nisa says, "We sent not an apostle, but to be obeyed in accordance with the will of Allah." Chapter 4, verse 64. We send prophets so that the people obey them. In what things should they obey prophets? What is the subject of this obedience? There are hundreds of Quranic ayahs which explain this obedience. For example, the ayahs about jihad, administering justice and meting out punishments, as well as the ayahs on transactions with other people and on agreements with other countries. But if they violate their oaths after their covenant, the Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse number 12. These ayahs mean the government of Islam. They show that on these matters, the messenger of God should be obeyed. On the matter of defending the country, implementing the rules, executing social agreements and contracts, and agreements with other countries, and administering justice in society. On these matters, the messenger of God should be obeyed. This means government. Government has no other meaning. The authority of Islam has been mentioned with such explicit clarity. Of course, this authority is abundantly visible in the tradition and hadiths of the Holy Prophet and other infallible Imams. When the Holy Prophet himself, greetings be upon him and his household, was surrounded by the representatives of the people of Yathrib in order to invite him to that city, which was later on renamed as Madinat al-Nabi, City of the Prophet, and when they spoke to him in Mina, he asked them to make the same pledge, saying to them that he would come to the city provided that they defend and support him at the cost of their lives. And they agreed and promised to do so. Later on, when he entered Medina, he established an Islamic government and imposed the authority of Islam.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.